Matthew 17, 14 through 27 says, "And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and kneeling before him said, 'Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly, for often he falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples and they could not heal him.' And Jesus answered, 'O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me.' And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, 'Why could we not cast it out?' He said to them, 'Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you.' As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day.' And they were greatly distressed. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, 'Does your teacher not pay the tax?' He said, 'Yes.' And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, 'What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?' And when he said, 'From others,' Jesus said to him, 'Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself.'"
Thanks, Rachel. Well, this morning we are continuing our sermon series in the book of Matthew. And as we do, it's important before we jump into this particular passage this morning just to kind of remember the context and where we are in Matthew and where our passage fits within that overall context. And so if you remember, we're in this section of Matthew in which Jesus is making his way, this long journey to Jerusalem, where he's going to be killed and crucified and die. And this section, if you remember, started in chapter 16, verse 21, and is going to extend all the way through chapter 20. And while he's on his way then to Jerusalem with his disciples within the section, he's going to do two things. And this is the primary overall focus and point of this section here in which Jesus is going to Jerusalem with his disciples. He's going to explain to them the essence and nature of his messiahship, like what it means for him to be the Messiah, the implications of what it means for him to be the Messiah. And he's also then going to explain to them the essence and nature of their discipleship and what it means to be a follower of this sort of Messiah that he's going to explain to them on their way to Jerusalem. And so then if you remember going back to chapter 16, we saw there that the disciples, and particularly Peter here, that the disciples know that Jesus is the Christ. They know that he's the promised Messiah that was to come. That was their confession, in particular Peter's confession in Matthew 16:16, when he confessed, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." So they know that. But what they don't know and what they don't fully understand at this point are the implications of that and what that fully means for Jesus to be the Christ. Like in their mind, they think Christ, they think Messiah, they think the Davidic king means triumph, means conquering, means glory. And so they think that a follower of this Christ then also means those same exact things. And so then, as Jesus then makes his way to Jerusalem with his disciples, he's going to explain to them further and really blow their minds when it comes to what it really means to be the Messiah. And it doesn't just mean glory and triumph and conquering. It means suffering and death. And to be a follower of this Messiah doesn't just mean glory and triumph and conquering. It too means suffering and death. In many ways, what we're going to see within this section is really a picture, I guess is what you might want to call it, of just what the Christian life is all about. In other words, if you're a Christian here this morning, You have confessed that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, just like Peter did and the disciples did in Matthew chapter 16:16. Like you've confessed that if you're a Christian. Meaning at a point in time that you declared that, you professed that, you confessed that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and you were born again. You were saved, you were converted, you became a Christian and a follower of Jesus by his grace instantaneously at that point in time. But even though you made that confession, you still didn't fully understand everything there was to know. And you didn't fully understand everything that you were to continue to grow in understanding about Jesus and about just the beauty and the depth of the gospel. Like, don't get me wrong, you knew the essential elements of the gospel that everyone has to know in order to trust Jesus and be born again at that particular point in time. But there was still a whole lot more that you had to learn and grow in and understand, and you're still learning and growing and understanding. And you also didn't understand at that point in time just the full weight and the full, and really grasp just the full implications then of what it means to follow Jesus and what it means to be a disciple of Jesus and what this would fully mean for the rest of your life. Instead, it's a process. We know it's sanctification. It's a process that involves spending time in the Word and teaching and being taught the Word and the preaching of the Word and spending time with other believers in the church. And through all of that, then you're growing in your knowledge. You're growing in your understanding. You're growing in your knowledge and understanding of the implications of what it means for Jesus to be the Messiah King and for you to be a follower of this sort of Christ and this sort of Messiah. And none of us have fully arrived there yet. Like we didn't just, okay, I got it all down. Instead, even this morning, even this very day, we're growing in our knowledge and our understanding of the depth of what it means for Jesus to be the Messiah and for what it means for us to be a follower of this sort of Messiah. And that's the whole point of what Jesus is doing here in this section as he makes his way from Galilee to Jerusalem, where he's going to die, from Matthew chapter 16, verse 21, all the way through the end of Matthew 20. He's unpacking and further explaining to his disciples. He's continually trying to explain to them the implications, the ramifications, the essence and nature of his messiahship, what it means for him to be the Messiah, and what it means for them to be a disciple and a follower of this sort of Messiah. And that's going to be the main focus of what we're going to see in our passage here this morning. That in our passage here, what Jesus is going to do is two different times, he's going to pull his disciples away from the crowd, and he's going to give them a little private teaching lesson. He's going to pull his disciples away from the crowd and give them a private instruction, particularly as it relates to what it means for them to be a follower of Jesus. He's going to give them two really important lessons of what it means for them to be a disciple of this sort of Messiah. And as we dive into these two particular lessons, what we're going to see is that these lessons aren't just relevant for the 12 disciples way back then. Instead, we're going to see these two lessons are extremely relevant for disciples today. For us, as we're trying to continue to understand and grow in our understanding and the depth of what it means, the implications of what it means to be a follower of this sort of Jesus. Two lessons that he teaches his disciples about what that means, and two lessons for what he teaches Cross Fellowship Church for what that means. So the first lesson we're going to see is this. You can see it on your hand out there. It's that as disciples of Jesus, we're to have ongoing faith and dependence on the Lord. As disciples of Jesus, we're to have ongoing faith and dependence upon him. So this is what we're going to see there starting in verse 14. Look there at verse 14 with me. Matthew writes this. He says, and when they, and the they here, specifically a reference to what he talked about in chapter 17, verses 1 through 13, it's specifically a reference to Jesus and three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John. If you remember, they went up on the Mount of Transfiguration, and now they're making their way down the mountain. And as they come down the mountain, verse 14 says, and when they, Jesus and Peter, James, and John, came to the crowd, a man came up to him, talking about Jesus, and kneeling before him, said, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly. For often he falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him. So here's the picture. You have a father who has this son who has these terrible seizures. And when we get to verse 18, we're going to see that the reason he has this seizure, these seizures is because he's possessed by a demon. Now, in saying that, this is really important, that does not mean that everybody who ever has a seizure is possessed by a demon. But it was the case for this particular son, this particular boy. And so this father then is worried about a son because he has these seizures all the time, and these seizures would oftentimes happen around fires and around water. And so you're like, well, what's that all about? Well, in that day, there was common to have open fires for cooking and heating and things like that. And there was also common they would have a well of water to draw water from, to drink and all that. And so you have this boy then who has seizures and has oftentimes fallen into these open fires and have often fallen into these bodies of water, these wells of water. And so needless to say, this father is worried about his son. He thinks he's going to fall in the fire, fall in this well and die when he has one of these seizures, and he's concerned about him. And so what he did then, when Jesus and these three disciples were on this mountain in the beginning of chapter 17, this man, this father then takes his son to the other nine disciples and asks them to heal his son. Asks them to cast this demon out of his son. Which, you hear that, and that would have made sense, right? If you remember all the way back in chapter 10, specifically in verse 1 of chapter 10 and verse 8 of chapter 10, Jesus gave his disciples authority to do a whole bunch of things. He gave them authority to heal the sick, to raise the dead, to cleanse lepers, and it also says to cast out demons. So in all likelihood, this would have been well known. People would have known about this. The disciples were doing these things. But if you look at the very end of verse 16 there, in chapter 17, it says that when this father brought his son to these nine disciples to heal him, they weren't able to do it. They weren't able to heal him. And so then because of that, then the father then sees Jesus coming down this mountain, and he brings his son to Jesus as he's coming down this mountain. And look then at how Jesus responds to this father's request to heal his son. We see it in verse 17. It says, and Jesus answered, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. And so there's some debate here regarding who Jesus is referring to here and talking about here when he talks about this faithless and twisted generation. So is he specifically referring to the disciples? Is he specifically referring to this father? Is he specifically referring to the crowds that were there watching? Like who's this faithless and twisted generation that Jesus is referring to here in verse 17? Well, throughout Matthew will oftentimes, or Jesus will oftentimes, refer to this generation. We see this nine different times in the book of Matthew. And each time that this generation is mentioned, it's always in reference to the Jewish generation that was alive at the time that the Messiah came and who saw the Messiah and heard the Messiah with their very own eyes and with their very own ears and still rejected him. That's how this generation is oftentimes, or all nine times, used within the book of Matthew. And so in all likelihood, that's who Jesus is referring to here and has in mind here in verse 17 when he talks about this twisted and perverse generation. But it's interesting what he's doing here, though. In all likelihood, what he's doing is he's lumping his disciples now into this faithless and twisted generation because of their inability to heal the son's man. or this man's son. And he's lumping them into that. And we're going to see why here in just a few verses later. But Jesus here, if you notice, in these questions he's asking in verse 17, he's exasperated with them. He says, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? And that's language from the Old Testament, Deuteronomy chapter 32, and also in the book of Numbers, in which God says the same exact thing about his people Israel. And so look then at verse 18 and how Jesus responds then to this man's request. Verse 18. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. So do you see that? It took Jesus like a nanosecond to accomplish what the disciples weren't able to do. He did in an instant what the disciples weren't able to do. Look then at verse 19 there and what the disciples did and how they responded when they saw what Jesus was able to do in healing this boy. Verse 19 says, then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not cast it out? And look at Jesus' answer there in verse 20. He said to them, because of your little faith, which goes back to faithlessness and this faithless and twisted generation there in verse 17. Because of your little faith. He's saying that's why you couldn't do it. That's why you couldn't cast out that demon. It's because of your little faith. And if you've been along in our sermon series on Matthew, you hear this rebuke here, this accusation here, your little faith, and you're like, we've heard that before. And I'm like, yeah, we have heard that before. Like five different times in the book of Matthew, Jesus rebukes his disciples for their little faith. And that's what he does here. He rebukes them. He says that the reason you couldn't heal this boy is because of your little faith. Your faith is small. It's little. In the rest of verse 20 then, this is really important to see the relationship between verse 19 and verse 20 here. Jesus goes on to explain just how little their faith is. He goes on to explain just how minuscule and tiny and little bitty the disciples' faith is. Look at what he says in the rest of verse 20. He says, for truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. So you see what he's doing there? He's saying, this is how small, this is how itty bitty your faith is, disciples. It's not even the size of a mustard seed. Like in that day, a mustard seed was super tiny. It was one of the smallest objects you could see with the naked eye. It was 0.039 inches. I did some hard math this week, right? That's really itty bitty. It's minuscule. You see what Jesus is saying then? Why he brings up this mustard seed idea? He's saying that the disciples' faith wasn't even that big. It wasn't even the size of a mustard seed. Because if it would have at least been the size of a mustard seed, they would have been able to move mountains. In other words, they would have been able to cast this demon out of this boy. But the fact that they couldn't do that reveals that they didn't even have faith the size of a little bitty mustard seed. In other words, it reveals that their faith was practically invisible, that their faith was practically non-existent. Now, in saying all that, it's important when we come to verse 20 here to realize that when Jesus mentions their faith being able to move a mountain, he isn't speaking literally here. Like this is figurative speech that he's using here. He's not literally saying, disciples, if you just had enough faith, then you'd be able to literally move this mountain from point A to point B. Instead, throughout the Old Testament, on a number of different occurrences, we see this phrase talk about moving a mountain, and Paul uses it in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 2, and every time that it's used figuratively in reference to doing something that's exceedingly difficult. And that's how Jesus is using it here. And so the point then of verse 19 and verse 20 isn't that if you just believe enough, if you just have enough faith, then you can accomplish anything, even moving a mountain. Like that's not the point. That's not the point of those verses. And the point of those verses also isn't all of your unanswered prayers then are a result of you not believing enough. All of your unanswered prayers then are a result of you not having enough faith. Again, that's not what Jesus is saying here. Like, let me give you an example. I don't care how much faith I have, I'm never going to have a full head of hair. Right? It's just never going to happen. I don't care how much faith I have, how much I believe, I am never going to be the starting quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. Don't say amen, you know. It's never going to happen. Instead, if you read this verse here, Jesus is teaching the exact opposite of all of those things. He's not saying that the more faith you have, then the more impossible things that God's going to be able to do. He's teaching the exact opposite. He's teaching that just a little bit of faith, even the size of a mustard seed, can accomplish great things. But the reason it can accomplish great things isn't because of how big our faith is. It's because of how big and powerful the object of our faith is, namely God. But again, think about this. The disciples, though, they didn't even have that. They lacked this sort of faith. They lacked this sort of faith. They didn't have this sort of faith when they tried to cast this demon out of this boy and heal this boy. That Jesus had given them authority to do this. But they didn't combine that authority with even a mustard seed size of faith. Their faith was practically like, again, non-existent. Now, in saying that, Jesus here doesn't go on to give us a lot of explanation here about their lack of faith here. But if you turn to Mark and the parallel account of this account in Mark's gospel, in Mark chapter 9, verse 29, Mark is going to say that the reason the disciples weren't able to cast out this demon was because they didn't pray. And so you hear that, and then you read this account in Mark or Matthew chapter 17, and it begs the question then, okay, which one is it? Like, could the disciples not heal this boy because they lacked faith, like Matthew says, or could the disciples not heal this boy because they didn't pray, like Mark says? Like, which one is it? Well, do you know what the answer is? The answer is yes. You with me? The answer is, the reason is yes. The reason is it's both. In other words, Matthew and Mark aren't contradicting each other. Matthew and Mark aren't saying different things here. Instead, in all likelihood, the way the disciples revealed their lack of faith was by their failure to pray. That their faithlessness was expressed in prayerlessness. It was expressed by their failure to depend upon God and rely upon the Lord was expressed by their failure to pray. Instead, in all likelihood there, for some reason, they probably believed that since Jesus had given them authority all the way back in Matthew chapter 10 to cast out demons, they could just like show up and voila, and just like mechanical, just do it themselves. Without praying, without crying out to the Lord, and without relying upon God's power to do it. They had the power in and of themselves, and they could just do it themselves. And so their failure to pray then revealed their lack of faith, their non-existent faith, and their trust and their reliance upon God, and instead their reliance upon their own strength and their own ability and their own power to do it. And so you hear that and you're like, okay, now this story is becoming pretty relevant. At first, it was all about casting out demons. That didn't seem all that relevant. But now if you're going to talk about rely upon the Lord instead of rely upon yourself and revealing about that through prayer, okay, yeah, this is starting to become pretty relevant now. And I'm like, man, it sure is. So think about this. Like, think about the mountains in your life right now. Things that are exceedingly difficult in your life right now. For most of you, it's not a demon-possessed son. There's a lot that could be said there. For most of you, it's a difficult parenting situation. It's a difficult marriage situation. It's maybe singleness. It's a difficult ministry situation you're involved in. Maybe it's a certain temptation, a certain sin that you're trying to resist. Maybe it's a health issue. Maybe it's a workplace issue. Maybe it's a hard decision that you're trying to make a decision about and you're wrestling about and all of those things. And so the question is, as you're identifying, what is that exceedingly difficult thing in your life right now? What is that mountain in your life right now? The question is, like, what is your initial response when it comes to that extreme difficulty in your life? Do you try and move it yourself? Do you try and fix it yourself? Do you try and solve it yourself by your own strength, by your own ability, by your own smarts and ingenuity? Or do you fall on your knees and cry out to the Lord in prayer and dependence upon Him, ask Him to do in His power what only He can do in and of Himself? And so I know, like, the end of verse 20 here can be abused in 1,000 different ways. At the same time, in the midst of all those abuses, there is a kernel of truth here that most of us in this room really need to remember. And that truth is this: we serve an omnipotent God. That God is all powerful. That there is nothing too difficult for God. Like a pastor friend of mine years ago once said, there is nothing God does that is any harder than anything else God does. Like, think about that for just a minute. There is nothing God does that is any harder than anything else God does. Like, He never comes up against something that tests His omnipotence. He never comes up against something that He thinks, oh, what I did yesterday was a lot easier than what I'm being asked to do here. That's not the case. Nothing is too difficult. Nothing is too hard for Him. And since that's true, then instead of relying upon ourselves, depending upon ourselves and our own ability and strengths and ingenuity and acting like we're the omnipotent one, instead, we as disciples and followers of Jesus are to rely upon His power and His strength when we face mountains and to express that reliance upon Him through prayer. And crying out to Him to act and to move and as we depend upon Him. So that's lesson number one, then, that Jesus teaches us as disciples. Not relying upon ourselves and our own strength, but relying upon Him and expressing that through believing and dependent prayer. Lesson number two He teaches the disciples and us then is this. Is that as disciples of Jesus, we're to lay down our rights and freedoms for the sake of the gospel. So this is what we're going to see in verse 24 here. We're going to get back to verse 22 and 23 here in just a second. But look at verse 24. Here's what happens next. It says in verse 24, when they, now talking about Jesus and the 12 disciples, came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the tax? And Peter said, yes, meaning he pays the tax. So then let's stop here just real quick and better understand kind of what this tax is that's being talked about and asked about here. This 2 drachma tax is a reference to the temple tax. And so in that day, Every year, a Jewish male over the age of 20 was required to pay a tax that would fund the temple. It would fund the priest, it would fund the daily sacrifices in the temple and the whole sacrificial system, and all that happened within the temple would be funded by this yearly temple tax that was to be paid by all Jewish males over the age of 20. And this temple tax was 2 drachma, which would be an equivalent of like 2 days worth of a wage. And so for some reason then, we don't know exactly why, but these tax collectors who collect this temple tax, so these would have been Jewish tax collectors, come up to Peter and ask Peter, hey, does that teacher of yours that you've been following around, does he pay this tax? Does he pay this temple tax? Because he's a Jewish male over the age of 20. And Peter looks at him and he says, yes, meaning he pays the tax. Then look what happens next there in verse 25. It says, and when he, talking about Peter, came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, what do you think, Simon? So Simon is Peter's name in Hebrew here. And he asked, from whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others? So what Jesus does here is he mentions and brings up 2 other taxes that would have been well known in that day. He brings up what's called the toll tax, which is translated as the word toll here in the ESV, and the poll tax or the head tax, which was taken when a census was taken, which is translated just as the word tax here in the ESV. And so what Jesus is asking Peter is who the kings of the earth, who earthly kings collect taxes from. Do they collect taxes from their own sons, or do they collect taxes from others, meaning those who aren't their sons, everybody else? And look at Peter's answer there in verse 26. And when he, talking about Peter here, said from others, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free, meaning they're free from paying this tax. And Peter was right. Like in that day, kings in that day, the sons of kings in that day were exempt from paying taxes. They didn't have to pay taxes. They weren't required to pay taxes. They were exempt from paying taxes. They were free, using the language here, from paying taxes. And so then you read that and you're like, okay, I know what Jesus is doing here, right? You begin to connect the dots here. And what Jesus is trying to teach Peter here. And he's basically saying, what he's implying here is, okay, Peter, if the sons of earthly kings are exempt from paying taxes, then Jesus, the son of the heavenly king, God, is exempt from paying tax on God's house, the temple. That's Jesus' point. Hey, Peter, I'm exempt then too from having to pay this temple tax. Because my father is the king, and this is his house. So I don't have to pay it either. But look what he does in verse 27. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. So take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. So don't lose sight of the miracle that Jesus is talking about here. Right? Jesus doesn't tell Peter, okay, Peter, just take that big old net of yours, throw it in the water, bring that net up with all the fish in it, start gutting all those fish, and hopefully within those 300 fish, one of those fish will have a shekel in it that you can use to pay the temple tax for me and you. I mean, that would have been pretty cool and amazing. Instead, do you see what he says? Tells Peter to do? He says, get a hook, cast it in the water, and the first fish, like the first one, not like 300, 400, 500, but the first one that you pull up, it's going to have a shekel in it. And take that shekel and pay that tax for us. Like that's a miracle. But here's the point. As miraculous as that miracle would have been, that miracle isn't the ultimate point of this story. Like the ultimate point of this story isn't, look at the amazing miracle that Jesus did. Instead, the ultimate point of this story is why Jesus did it. And we see why Jesus did it in the very beginning of verse 27. He did it in order to not give offense to them. Did you catch that? He did it in order to not be offensive and to give an offense to them. That's the reason. That's why he paid the tax, even though he had every right not to pay the tax. He didn't have to pay this tax. But he did. And he did it in order to not give offense to them, because him not paying that tax would have given offense to the tax collectors and the crowds. And so he paid it in order to not give offense to them. Wow. Now, it's really important. This word that's translated there as offense in verse 27, it's used a whole bunch in Matthew, like a whole bunch of times. And it's oftentimes translated, and I think this is the meaning here in verse 27, as the word stumbling block. As the word stumbling block. Because that's what would have happened if Jesus wouldn't have paid the tax, this temple tax. If he didn't pay the temple tax, then think about what that would have communicated then to the tax collectors. Think about what that would have communicated to the crowds, and think about what that would have communicated to others. And so Jesus knew it would have caused like this unnecessary stumbling block to them. It would have hindered them from believing that he was really the Messiah King that God promised. And because it would have been a hindrance and an obstacle and a stumbling block for them to believe that he was truly the Messiah, then he laid down his rights and freedoms, and he went ahead and paid the tax for he and Peter, even though technically he had every right not to. Now, in saying all that, it's really important that Jesus wasn't against offending people. Jesus wasn't against being a stumbling block and offending people. In fact, in Matthew chapter 15, verse 12, we see Jesus's disciples come up to Jesus and they ask him, "Don't you know that the Pharisees were offended by something that he said?" And that word offended is the same exact word that we see in verse 27 here, means a stumbling block, a hindrance. And specifically in Matthew 15, what offended them, what was a stumbling block to them, what was a hindrance to them, is that Jesus told the Pharisees, it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person. Because they had really crooked, defiled hearts. And so then, Jesus doesn't believe, don't offend at all cost. He was fine to offend to the Pharisees when it came to like black and white issues of truth, when it came to the truth of what God's word says, when it came to sin issues like their hypocrisy and their dirty hearts, and when it came to their man-made traditions and their man-made rules that they'd put together. When it came to all those things, he didn't mind offending them. He didn't mind offending them when it came to all of those things. But when it came to gray areas where there weren't clear black and white issues in Scripture, gray areas that would fall under the category of personal freedoms, then Jesus sought not to offend. Jesus sought not to be a stumbling block to others. And this is the model and the lesson that he was teaching for the disciples then. And this is the model and lesson that he's trying to teach us as disciples today. Like, just think about it. There are a whole host of things that you and I as Christians are free to do. There's no clear verse and chapter in the Bible that says, don't do that or don't do that. There's a whole host of things that are gray areas that we're free to do. But before we just do them because we want to do them and because they're gray areas and we can do them because the Bible doesn't say not to do them, Instead, what we need to ask is, by doing them or not doing them, will this hinder my witness for the gospel with my coworkers? Will this create a stumbling block for others when it comes to the gospel? Will this keep someone from listening to me and me gaining a hearing from somebody and what I have to say about the gospel? And so I know in saying all this, like, it sounds overly simplistic. And I get that. Like, these are all super complicated questions that require a whole lot more nuance than I have time for to get into this morning. At the same time, this is the lesson Jesus is modeling and teaching us here. And it's what the Apostle Paul continually wrote about in many of his letters as well, especially in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 12. In 1 Corinthians 9, 12, he said, "We endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ." Anything. I'll endure anything than be a hindrance in some way, an obstacle in some way, a stumbling block in some way to people hearing the gospel and knowing the gospel. You hear that? So is that your heart posture? Is that how you think about gray areas and the freedoms that you have? I endure anything than put an obstacle, a hindrance in the way of the gospel and my ability to be able to share the gospel with others. Or do you care more about your freedoms and what you're free to do and what you want to do and what you have the right to do in all these gray areas that aren't black and white? You care more about that than you do gaining hearing from people with the gospel. This is not the best illustration going. It's the best one I could come up with. Amy and I bought our first house a long time ago. We had a neighbor. That neighbor loved his yard, loved it. First time I ever met this guy, all he talked about was all this blankety blank blank about everybody else who didn't keep their yard up. He despised people who didn't keep their yard up. He looked down on people he thought they were the worst person on earth. He thought they were the worst person on earth. Like, I learned that about a minute into meeting this guy. And then he reinforced that in the days ahead. And so, guess what? Guess who moved next door to this guy? A guy who barely even knew how to work a lawnmower, right? Me. A guy who, man, hated pulling weeds and mowing the yard and a little newly married couple who didn't have a whole lot of money to do any of those things. And so, like, I couldn't point you at that point in time to a chapter and verse that said, "Thou must keep a nice yard." There it says it in 1 Corinthians. I couldn't find a verse that said that in any way, shape, or form. So this was a gray area. Had some freedom in regards to what I'm going to do to my yard. But for the sake of my neighbor, and trying to maintain and keep a witness and a gospel testimony and a hearing with my neighbor, we stumbled and bumbled around, but did the best we could to take care of our yard. That's not an indictment on anybody here. And so I know that's a small issue, not the biggest issue, example, illustration I probably could have given. But think about how that might play itself out for you at your workplace, with your coworkers, with your neighbors in the neighborhood in which you live, with family members on Thanksgiving. Are there certain things you're free to do or free not to do? There's no chapter and verse you can point to that says, should do it, should not do it. but that might hinder your witness. Serve it as an obstacle, a hindrance, a stumbling block to your testimony and witness of the gospel. If so, then let me encourage you, pay the temple tax. Just lay it down. Give it up for the sake of the gospel. And here's why, the ultimate reason why. It's because that's what Jesus did for you and me. Didn't he? I mean, just think about it. Go back to these two verses we skipped earlier. Verse 22 in chapter 17 there. What's Jesus say? It says verse 22, and while they were gathering together in Galilee, verse 22, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed, talking about his disciples. So remember the context here, right? Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, where he's going to be killed and died, and everything he's talking about here is going to happen. And while he's on the way there, he knows that when that happens, that's going to freak out his disciples. Like, that's going to be a big deal to them. They're thinking Messiah. They're thinking triumph, glory. He's talking about death and suffering. And so he's trying to prep them. He's trying to prepare them for what's about to happen to them. And if you remember, this is the second time Jesus is preparing them. We saw the first time last week in chapter 16, verse 21. But if you remember the first time Jesus prepares them and tells them what's about to happen to them and how he's going to suffer and die and all those things, Peter then speaks up and he rebukes Jesus. He's like, "No, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen to you, Jesus." Because in Peter's mind, he's protesting and rebuking Jesus when he makes his first prediction about a suffering death. Because in Peter's mind, the disciples' mind, that's not what happens to Messiahs. Messiahs don't suffer and die. Messiahs conquer and rule and triumph. But here, the disciples don't protest this time. They don't rebuke Jesus this time. Instead, you see how they responded? It says they became greatly distressed. And that's kind of a good thing. Like they're coming along. Like instead of protest or rebuke, "No, that's not going to happen. That's not what happens to Messiahs." It's beginning to sink in a little bit. "Oh, this Messiah's going to die. And we're sad. We're grieving because of that." But here's the point, one of the most important parts we're supposed to notice there in verse 22. Did you notice how Jesus refers to himself, the title he gives himself in verse 22? He refers to himself as the Son of Man. Usually in the Gospels and forever, like I always thought when I see the title Son of Man, it's simply referring to Jesus' humanity. All it's saying, it's code word for he's a human. And Son of God means that Jesus is deity and that he's God. But this title here, Son of Man, Jesus calls himself the Son of Man here in verse 22. And why does he do that? Well, this title, Son of Man, that Jesus uses to refer to himself is specifically a reference to the Old Testament book of a title that's used in the Old Testament book of Daniel. The Old Testament prophet Daniel, in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. And in Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14, Daniel is describing this vision that he sees. And here's the vision that Daniel sees in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. Daniel writes this. He says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like," here it comes, "a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him." Now listen to how Daniel describes this Son of Man. "And to him," talking about this Son of Man, "was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." So do you see who the Son of Man here is here? He's the one who's going to be given dominion. He's the one who's going to be given glory. He's the one who's going to be given a kingdom, and that all the nations and tongues and tribes on the earth are going to bow down and serve and worship him. It's Daniel chapter 7. But in Matthew 17, verse 22, do you see what this Son of Man is going to do? He's going to give up his right to glory. He's going to give up his right to honor. He's going to give up his right to majesty. He's going to forfeit all of that in order to come down to this earth and take on human flesh so that he can be delivered into the hands of men so that they can slaughter him and kill him. And you ask the question, why does he give all that up? Why does he forfeit all of that? Like, all of that is rightfully his. Why does he lay all of that down? Well, you know, so he could save us. So he could save you. So he could save me. So that he could substitute himself in the place of everyone and anyone who would ever place their faith and trust in him. To save us from the judgment that we deserve for our sin. And so now then, as those who've been saved because Jesus laid down his rights to glory and honor and majesty for us, we're then compelled to lay down our rights and our freedoms for the sake of others, just like he did for us. And it was through him laying down those rights to honor, glory, and power that he received honor, glory, and power through his resurrection. And the same is true for you if you're a Christian, and for me. And so then, if you're a Christian here this morning, and if you have made the same confession that Peter made in Matthew 16:16, if you have confessed that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, then just like the disciples here that we looked at this morning, you and I, as disciples of Jesus, we're still growing. We're still learning. We're still journeying along with Jesus along the road. And he's teaching us a lot of new lessons. Lessons that we know and have heard, but lessons we need repeated, like the ones today, and that we still need to grow in. Lessons about faith and the ongoing faith and dependence that we need to have on him, the God who can move mountains, and lessons about freedom and laying down our rights and laying down our freedoms for the sake of the gospel, just like Jesus did. And so as we leave here this morning, after we're done here this morning, then let the omnipotent power of God cause you to trust and depend upon him and pray as you struggle with those mighty mountains in your life, rather than depend upon yourself. And secondly, let the selfless humility of Jesus cause you to lay down and forfeit your freedoms and forfeit your rights, just like he did for you, so that people will hear and know and understand the gospel. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your grace upon us. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you that we are on a journey to ourselves as disciples of Jesus today. And we have confessed Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. But man, we have a long way to grow and go in knowing the full implications of what that means for our lives. What that means for him to be our Messiah, our Davidic King who reigns and rules. And all that's involved in that. And what it means to be a follower of that Messiah and King. Thank you for the things that we've learned and grown in, and that you've revealed to us. But Lord, I pray that we would continue to learn lessons. Lessons about faith, dependence, prayer, not depend upon ourselves, but ultimately depend upon you. Having faith, even the size of a mustard seed, in an all-powerful, omnipotent God can do a lot of things. Not because of our faith, but because of the bigness of our God. And freedom to yield, to give up, so we would not be a hindrance and a stumbling block and an obstacle in our testimony and our witness of the gospel. Oh God, work that in our hearts as we have as we've seen that demonstrated in Christ. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.